state your name again.
My name is Albert Knutson, 105 3rd Street North, Moorhead, Minnesota.
Albert, where were you born?
I was born in Slayton, Minnesota.
How big a town is that?
Oh, it's about like Barnesville, Minnesota is here.
Who are your parents?
My parents are Tom and Inga Knutson. They're both deceased now.
What did they do?
They were farmers, but they were both born in Norway.
How old were they when they came over to the U.S.? Do you know?
Pardon?
Do you know how old they were when they came over to the United States?
Yeah, my mother was 24 and my dad was 22.
Where did you go to high school?
No, I didn't.
Okay. What did you do prior to entering the military?
I was partly on the railroad and partly farming.
What was the last grade that you completed?
Well, 8th grade.
Were you drafted?
Yes, I was.
How did you feel about that?
Not too good.
Pretty scary, huh?
Yeah.
What branch of the service did you serve?
I served in the Army Engineers.
What was your military training like?
Military, we had 13-week basic training.
And where was that?
It was at Camp Robinson, Arkansas, right next to Little Rock.
Where did you go from training?
We went on Army maneuvers in Tennessee and Georgia.
And how long were you there?
The maneuvers lasted about 3 weeks, I think.
Albert, what were some of your best memories during training?
Well, the best thing I can remember is it made you physical.
Yeah, a lot of exercise.
It's a good course. It's good to take. It's good for everybody.
Did you serve overseas?
Yes, I did.
And where was that?
Southwest Pacific.
And what did you do?
We was in the Army Engineers. We built airfields over there.
So where did you first go to? Where was your first stop?
Our first stop, I mean, as far as the war, is in the northern part of Australia.
And how did you get there? Were you on a ship?
Yes, we did, yeah. We went on a ship, and then plus we went on a train.
Tell us about the ship voyage.
You want to hear about the ship voyage?
I certainly do. Tell us all you can remember about your voyage over to Australia.
The basic training, that takes care of that.
How many people were on the ship, Albert?
There was 4,400 soldiers and 200 nurses.
How many were really supposed to be on that ship? What was it built for? How many people?
There was a 600-passenger liner between New York and Cuba. And they converted to a troop transport, and they put 4,400 on there.
What were the conditions like, being that crowded on that type of ship?
It was crowded. They stacked us up five high. I happened to be in what used to be a prom room, and they stacked the bunks up five high and about 30 inches between the aisle. You climb up there, and this is where you slept.
Any seasickness?
I didn't, but a lot of them did.
And what was that like?
Terrible. Mm-hmm. Especially in a crowded condition like that. Mm-hmm. That was so crowded.
What did they do when they were seasick in such crowded conditions?
Now, I'll tell you, we had helmets, you know, and they have liners in them. Mm-hmm. We take the liners out and use the helmet to throw up in.
Oh.
And then, of course, you had to empty them out in your toilet facilities were pretty bad because the toilet facilities were for a 600-passenger ship, and here was 4,400, so you always stood in line.
Mm-hmm. How about feeding that many people?
The same thing. The kitchen was just the right size for 600 or 600 or 800 passengers, and there was 4,400. So we only had two meals a day, and it took 6 hours to go through the chow line. Mm-hmm. So you start feeding breakfast at 5 in the morning, and you're not through at breakfast till 11, and at 2 o'clock to start feeding supper.
Wow. Was there enough food to last for that many people for the length of time it took to get to?
It did until the last 3-4 days.
Then what happened?
We run short.
Was there rationing?
We had to go into sea rations and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was tough because it took 34 days to get there.
34 days.
Yeah.
Any special situations that stand out in your mind during those 34 days other than the seasickness and the overcrowded conditions?
Okay, I can give you a resume of it.
That'd be great.
Okay. We got on the ship in New York on January 23rd, 1942. And there was 8 troop ships. We pulled out of New York and early in the morning, and we went right past the Statue of Liberty. And there were 5 or 4 escort vessels, 1 cruiser and 3 destroyers. When we outside of New York, we thought sure we were going to Europe or North Africa, but we kept on going south. And that for 2-3 days we kept going south. All of a sudden we noticed we were at the Keys of Florida. So we knew we must be going to the South Pacific. So in another day or two, we could see the Panama Canal. And this is where we went through the Panama Canal. That's quite a feat, that Panama Canal.
What was it like?
Before we could get there, we'd seen a whole lot of balloons up in the air, different kind of heights, and we were wondering what they're doing up there. So they finally announced on the sound system on the boat that they were balloons holding steel cables up so that any enemy plane couldn't come in low and bomb the locks, you know, that lifts the ship up. And to see those, get in those locks, it takes 3 locks to go up. And you go up 40 feet in each one, so you go up over 100 feet up to a lake. And then you sail across the lake for about 15 miles. Then you go right through a mountain. They cut through the mountain way back in about 1913, I think it was. And you go through there, and that is quite a feat to see that rock go hundreds of feet, and they've blown all that stuff out of there.
Awesome.
And when we went through there, you could stick your hand out on the end of the ship and touch the wall, the rock wall.
It was that tight?
It was that close, yeah, it was that close. Then, of course, you went down the same way as you went up. And when we got through there, we stopped and picked up some more stuff at Balboa. There's the name of the town, I think it was. And then we started. On February 1st, we left Panama, sailing straight west by southwest. The weather is now very hot, even at sea. And on February 4th, we crossed the equator.
What was that like?
That was something, it's a difference. You're on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't see it or anything, but mm-hmm. it was kind of a unusual thing to know you're on the other side of the equator.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, our ship turned off from the rest of the convoy, and we sailed into the harbor of Tahiti Island and refueled from a tanker in the bay at Bora Bora Island. The natives came out in small boats with some jungle fruits and traded some of the people on board. We used a string. We'd put some fruit on the end of the string, and we'd tie a pack of cigarettes or something on and let it down to them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a ball doing that. The only thing is, they were mostly almost naked, you know. Okay, February 14th, we left Tahiti, and we had to catch up with the rest of the convoy again. And on the 15th, we're now back with the convoy again, with 4 more troop ships joined our group. So there are now 12 troop ships. We crossed the international dateline last night. We skipped February 21st altogether. You skipped one day and you mm-hmm. crossed the international dateline. February 24th and 25th, sea is very rough, and many men are sick. There are 44 sailors and 200 nurses on board. Sight of land that morning, the coast of Australia. Sailing to the port of Melbourne, Australia, and docked about noon. Thousands of Australians were at the docks to welcome us. We were escorted by our Australian Army Band to our camp at Royal Park, a camp inside the city limits. We were the first American soldiers to arrive in Australia, and were they ever joyed. Sent cable to Dell that I had arrived safely. We had to send this cable through the religious organization because we couldn't tell where we were. And we stayed in Melbourne, Australia for quite a while, and we worked in a dock to unload all these ships that came in.
What was Melbourne, Australia like?
Melbourne, Australia is a big city. Mm-hmm. It's about like San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big city, and there are a lot of people in there. And there were a lot of those civilians over there. They came now. They never seen an American before.
Mm-hmm. How'd they treat you?
Treated just like kings, you know. And then a lot of them, they come down. We were down there. The civilians had come down to the camp, and they would invite some of us to come to their house when there was time off, you know, to feed us, because mm-hmm. they knew how we were living on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on a couple of them, and they really treated us real nice. And we had to unload all these ships that came in. And being in the engineers, why, we had to have a lot of equipment. And that didn't come on a troop ship, so we had to wait in Melbourne, Australia, until our freighters came in with all our equipment, trucks, tractors, bulldozers, and even tanks and stuff. So we had to wait, and they got here, and we had to unload all that stuff. And after we got that stuff all unloaded, we had to load it on trains because we were going to go to the northern part of Australia. So we loaded all our equipment on trains, and we left Melbourne by train. We have to change trains every time we cross the state line because they have a different gauge railroad. So that's a lot of extra work.
Mm-hmm.
So that took a lot of time. And we went to Adelaide, Australia, which is in the middle part of the southern part of Australia, and we turned north and went for Alice Springs, which is in the middle of Australia, and that's where the railroad ended.
Mm-hmm.
From there on, there was no railroad, so we had to unload all our equipment from the flat cars and load it on the trucks. Then we went across 1,000 miles of nothing but desert. No roads, no nothing. And it took 3-4 days, and dusty and dirty.
Hot.
Stop every 3 hours for a bathroom call mm-hmm. out in the middle of the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And eat the dust all the way. And then all our food was canned stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We got to a town by the name of Burdham, and there the railroad started again. That was about 300 miles from the northern part. We took the train for another 100 miles to a city named Catherine. That's just a small town. And we unloaded there, and we're about a mile out of that town. This is where we're going to build an airfield, because the Japanese were expected to be landing in Australia, in Darwin, Australia, which is about 200 miles north. They had already bombed and sunk all the ships in the harbor, and they bombed all the buildings. So we got off and started building an airfield there. And we were there for several months. And then instead of landing there, the Japanese landed in New Guinea instead, on north part of New Guinea. So then we pulled the stakes and loaded everything up on a train and went to Darwin. arrived at Darwin, staying in a Navy barracks while our ship was being loaded. Almost every building in the city has been bombed and burned by the Japs. October 10th, we loaded onto a Liberty ship and sailed off today. We went to New Guinea. As we went to Milne Bay, right at Milne Bay, New Guinea, pitched our camp up in pup tents in a coconut grove in ankle-deep mud and millions of ants and mosquitoes. Our eats now is nothing but dehydrated stuff and not even too much of that. Had our first bombing raid at 2:30 this morning. One bomb hit about 100 feet from our pup tents, scattered mud all over and our area, and everybody got scared and shaky. When it was all over, we didn't sleep much that night.
Was anyone hurt?
And the next night, I didn't write it down. I didn't write it down. The next night, the Japanese made that landing. Mm-hmm. They didn't know we were there. They thought it was just a few Australians, and they wanted that airfield. So they landed, and somebody had noticed them before they came, before dark. And we figured they wouldn't come in until after dark, and they were going to take over the landing strip. So we lined everything up on the opposite side of the landing, and all the guns we had and everything, you know, that we had, we weren't infantry, we were engineers. And the Japs landed, and they all come and they stormed the field. And we turned some searchlights on and started shooting, and by the time it was all done, there was no Japs left. They were all gone.
How many?
About 80 of them.
What did you do with them?
We had all we could do was we dug a hole and a bulldozer right next to the airfield and put them all in there and covered them up, marked it. Well, that was a tough deal.
What was that like? I mean, how did you feel after?
It's horrible. It's horrible.
It was either.
I tell you, to see something like that, it's.
It was you or them.
It's terrible. And then December 21st had several bombing raids so far, but have no directs on our campsite. On the 22nd, then we got so many troops have been in there already, and they have fixed, built the airfield. So the war was progressing up along the north coast of New Guinea, so we left. We left Milne Bay on old Dutch raider and heading for Oro Bay, about 155 miles further up the coast. December 23rd, 1942. Arrived at Oro Bay at midnight and went ashore in landing barges, and there was an alert of Jap infiltration as soon as we landed. So foxholes was the first thing we picked out a spot for. Also unloaded our ship by landing barges and a pontoon dock. That was tough over there on that. That's my makeshift stuff. This is Christmas Day of 1942.
Christmas Day.
Had 6 bombing raids last night, and our Christmas dinner was bully beef, dehydrated spuds, and Australian hardtack biscuits. That was our Christmas dinner. And then on January 2nd, we left Oro Bay by foot. It was full pack. We followed a native trail and got about 10 miles up the coast and pitched our camp. It rained all night, so all our stuff got soaking wet, so threw a lot of it away. Before gone, we were heading for Dabadura, about 5 miles on yet, and have no more to eat till we get there. Everybody is sweating, cussing the Japs for all he's worth. Got the rest of the way to Dabadura at noon, and now clearing an area for our camps closed. To where we are to build an airdrome. Our food or rations are dropped from army transport planes, so we get just barely enough to get along on. This is where the real battle was at this Dabadura. I mean, there's nothing. All the food we got had to come over by plane, and plane couldn't land. We didn't have air fleet, so you dropped it by parachute. Mm-hmm. And you could hear the guns in the distance.
Now, what city was this?
This is Dabadura. It's not a city. It's just a kind of a township name. It's Dabadura. There was no town there. It's just an area. But there, right, Buna was a town that is a few miles from there. There, we could hear the shooting going on all the time, bombing, and you could see it flares up in the air, and they were that close. And they needed them airfields so the airplanes could come in there.
Must have been very scary.
Well, then I didn't have much air for a while here, and then we built the airfield, and it was just about ready for planes. And it was on March 11, 43, 25 Jap bombers and 30 Zeros came in over our field at 10 o'clock this morning and caught us all out there by surprise and dropped their bomb load the length of the field. 6 men from my unit alone were killed, 4 in my company. 4 were killed, 1 lost its right hand, and several more were wounded. Got minor wounds. A lot of trucks, tractors, and planes and damaged. An airfield was full of a bomb crater. Now, by bomb crater, I want to explain that a little bit. They blocked maybe, I think it was over 100 bombs they dropped along the whole runway, tried to blow up the whole field. About 3/4 of them explode and blow a crater. The other are time-delayed bombs. They go into the ground and they don't explode until later on they're timed.
How long about?
Well, up to 24 hours. So the only way to beat that, because they had the airfield, we as engineers, we'd line up on in the runway and walk hand in hand, and we'd seen a hole about 10 inches in diameter. We put up a stick with a red flag on. Mm-hmm. There's a bomb down there. We do that, you don't know when it's going to go up. Mm-hmm. And then we had people that are a bomb squad. They were trained for that. They come and they put dynamite in there and explode the dynamite, and that exploded the bomb. Then it blew a crater, but then you could fill it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was that's kind of a scary job.
Very scary.
That was scary.
Was anyone hurt during the?
No, I mean we lucked out. Nobody got it. But They waited, I think it was 3 or 4 hours, because most of them would go off in that time. Then we kept on maintaining that airfield, you know, and after they got going, then we built another cross field for fighter plane. And the tough part was, I felt for these pilots flying these planes, these bombers and stuff. They go out and bomb the Jap stuff, and they come back and some of them, they can't get the wheels down,
to land.
And some of them have been, B-25s had double tail. One of them shot off, where you can see a hole right through the wing. Mm-hmm. They say when they come in their wing in a prayer, they did a lot of them.
Literally.
Yeah. And some of these fighters, P-38 fighters, so alongside the runway we built, they call it a dirt strip. Because the main runway we have steel matting on, you know, for the plane. But the dirt strip we had nothing in. So if they have to come in with the wheels up, they land right on there and they slide on the dirt. That way they keep from catching fire. Because if they slide on the metal, you know, the friction that's start a fire and they blow up. So they had, and then some came in. You know, one time one B-24, that's a 4-engine job, came in. And he landed. But the pilot had both his legs almost shot off. He couldn't use his feet. And so when he landed, he couldn't put the brakes on.
This is the pilot?
This is the pilot. The bullets went through and it damaged his legs. So he couldn't use them on his control.
Then what
happened? And so he couldn't put the brakes on. So he landed at the end of the runway. Mm-hmm. And on the other end of the runway was a whole bunch of airplanes, fighter planes. So about 3/4 of the way down, there's a ravine. So when he got that, he'd speed up the engines on one side to make the plane turn, and he'd go right in the ditch with that big airplane, and it broke in two. And they took him out of there. It was feet. I didn't see it, but they said he was just dangling there, and he passed out right away. So that was gruesome. And then what he did.
Did he make it? I mean, did he?
I don't know if he lived or not. because you don't hear those things. They don't tell you anything. So then the army, I noticed there was so airplanes were so important that they went down there and they took those four motors off so they can put them on other airplanes. That's how important it was to have them. Well, that was a bad deal there. And there were several of those P-38 fighter planes. They landed and they'd right down on the ground, and then the guy would walk out and just take a look at it. But they shot down a lot of planes. And there was a while there when they were at the most danger around there was the pilots in the fighter planes would sit in the airplane and wait. Because they didn't have any radar, I don't think, where we were, so they couldn't tell if an enemy plane was coming until you either seen them or heard them or could read the insignia on them. You know? And if they could, they took off like that, you know. And they shot down a lot of them. Well, after we've been there for so long, we never got any replacement. Finally, we just started to get a replacement. So our whole unit, we'd been almost 2 years in that one place, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Wow.
You know, no furloughs, no nothing, mm-hmm. See.
No breaks.
So finally, we took off, loaded our whole unit, the whole regiment, about 12, 1,400 men, on a Liberty ship, and we headed for Sydney, Australia, on a rest period. And I figured the boat ride would be about 10 days. We arrived in Sydney. March 6th, we arrived in Sydney. We went by truck or train to Warwick Farm, a camp at the outskirts of Sydney. Sure seems good to eat fresh food again.
No doubt. How long the time did you have off?
15 days. We got 15 days off.
What did you do?
We ate most of the time.
Oh, yeah.
Sydney is a big city, so we went to shows and stuff. I didn't mark any of that down. Furlough's over again. Here we had to back to the GI work again. But then the furlough's over, they called me in and for a medical deal. My tonsils were bad when I was in New Guinea, and they wouldn't take them out because they said your blood is too thin. So after the furlough, they called me in right away, and they wouldn't give me any more time there. And they took my tonsils out, and the blood was still too thin. It wouldn't stop bleeding. And then I got malaria on top of it.
While you were in the hospital, yeah. You contracted
malaria. Yeah, this is the army barracks.
And where was this?
Sydney, Australia.
You were in Sydney for the surgery.
So fever was so high, they never told me what it was, but I got it when I was in the hospital. I'd been there for about 10 days and I wouldn't bleed. Couldn't stop bleeding. So.
How long were you in the hospital?
I think it was about 3 weeks total. But they wrapped me in ice and they fed me, every hour they fed me quinine and Ativan for one whole night. And I looked up, everything was a blur. Windows and everything was a blur. The next morning it broke, you know, and I threw it all up.
Mm-hmm.
It was all green,
mm-hmm.
And it took so long, or so weak. It took about 3 weeks in the hospital. Well, that took care of that. Well, we had a party too, you know, the unit rented a company party at a town hall in downtown Sydney, you know.
Were you able to go?
Oh, yeah.
After
This was just before we left to go back. On July 17, we loaded on another Liberty ship again on our way back to the jungles again. We headed out again with all new equipment. August 15, 1940, we arrived. We're right back at the Sansipur, New Guinea, and cleared a jungle for aerodromes and road and camps. Are you familiar what New Guinea looks like? It's a big island, but that is further east again. And we were only there for about a month, and we had to move again because we're following the Marine. When they make a landing, they take it over, and we come in with the heavy equipment to build roads and airfields. That was our job. And we moved again on September 14, 1994 again, were loaded on an LST ship with all our equipment and moving out with a convoy for Morata Island. Morata Island is just south of the Philippines. Right at Morata Island this morning, waded ashore in knee-deep water and got our equipment unloaded and the campsite picked on. The equipment is already at work on an airfield which has to be finished in 24 hours. It is just 6 days since D-Day, so the jungles are all around are still alive with Japs. Jap planes are sneaking over every once in a while. That's what's scary over there. It's pretty close to the front. It is nice moonlight nights now, and the Japs are making use of it by coming over and dropping a few bombs every night. It is all coral rock, 1 foot beneath the ground surface, so have to use air compressor drills to dig trenches, crawl in there. Here's the good part. 24 of us got noticed to pack and get ready to leave tomorrow for good old USA.
Ooh, party.
We started to get replacements. Uh-huh. And we got 24 in, I guess, and we shipped out 24. That's the way it started. The 24 ones were ready to leave the right and early. They caught a plane. There was an army plane at 11 o'clock and went as far as Hollandia, New Guinea. That's about 700 miles. That's from Morata Island, you know, where the Celebes are. You know, they were next to them. We could see the smoke coming out of the volcanoes and stuff over there. And Hollandia, that was a long way, 700 miles from there. And then we got off there, and I was waiting for a boat to leave there. On November 11th, loaded on a Victory ship, Sea Raid, and sailed out heading for San Francisco. Oh, instead of going to ride direct, we went to Milne Bay where we went the first time, and we picked up 200 hospital patients. You know, we hadn't seen enough of that, so we had to see them come mm-hmm. without arms, without legs, and carry them on, all burned. Uh-huh. Then we sailed out from Milne Bay with the extra 200 hospital patients. There are 2,200 of us on this ship, and we are on our way to the good old USA. Crossed the international dateline today, so it'll still be November 24th tomorrow, too. November 30th, 1944. This is when we arrived at San Francisco. But I'd just like to say a little bit about before we got there. We could see that bridge. You know, from about 15 miles out.
Golden Gate?
Pardon?
Which bridge?
The Golden Gate Bridge
okay.
in San Francisco. We could see that bridge, and they said we have to sail under it, and I said, no, we'll never make it. That won't go underneath there, because, you know, the boat was that high.
Mm-hmm.
The closer we got, the higher the bridge got. And when we went under that bridge, there was still 100 feet to go, and you had 2,200 people hollering their heads off. Hooping and hollering. Well, that was a good feeling. I sailed under the Golden Gate Bridge at 9:27 p.m. I even had the right time on it. We were welcomed at the docks by an army band which played for over an hour. A large ferry boat took us out to Angel Island, where we are to be processed and issued OD uniforms. There's an island in San Francisco Bay they call Angel Island. It's strictly taken over by the Navy, or Army, or Navy. And we were there for 2 days, I guess. Then we left Angel Island again by a ferry boat and took us to the railway station, where we got on our troop trains and we're now on our way to our induction station.
And where was that?
Fort Snelling. December 7th, 44, arrived at Fort Snelling, getting processed again, getting more clothes before we leave on our furlough. Called out at her office in St. Paul. She was working for a selective service in St. Paul.
Now that would be Dolores, your
wife? Yeah, Dolores, yeah. And we went to her apartment, and then later on in the evening, we met some of her other friends, and then decided to get married on December 16th.
How long a furlough did you have?
I had 30 days.
30 days.
I got 30 days. So, went shopping a little bit the next morning, and then we caught a train out of St. Paul to Fergus Falls, and then Dell's folks met us in Fergus Falls, and we went down to Earhart and stayed there overnight. And on December 11th, we applied for marriage license. December 16th, got married at 8:30 this evening at Earhart. It was a very nice church wedding.
Grace Lutheran.
Well, we stayed around home there until December 29. Dell and I left home today for Fort Knox, where we will spend a few days at her apartment before leave for Hot Springs, Arkansas, to be reassigned again. January 4th, I left St. Paul for Hot Springs, Arkansas, by way of Chicago and St. Louis. Furlough's over, back to GI life again. Arrived at Hot Springs and stayed in the Majestic Hotel, which is taken over by the Army. We ate in the Arlington Hotel, which also run for the Army. We'll be here a couple of weeks. My brother Ted came over from Selma, Alabama to visit for a couple of days. He was taking pilot trainings in Selma. January 18, left Hot Springs, Arkansas by train for Fort Leonardwood, Missouri, going my way of Little Rock and Arkansas and Springfield, Missouri, on to Newberry, and from there by bus to Fort Leonardwood. Right, Fort Leonardwood, started 3 weeks training course to teach new recruits how to run heavy equipment. Left Fort Leonardwood by train for Camp Atterbury, Indiana. The reason I left, we were supposed to train new recruits in the Army engineering deal, but for some reason or other, they were short of MPs or something someplace. So they just called a bunch of us together and said, pack your stuff, we're leaving tomorrow morning for Camp Atterbury, Indiana, for military police training.
What did you think about that?
I didn't think anything. I couldn't figure out what in the world they wanted me to do that for.
To be a military police?
No. Anyway, I arrived at Camp Battery and started a 2-week training course in MP duty. After MP duty, of course, waiting to be shipped out to a new assignment. And they gave me a choice. I could either go to Cleveland, Ohio, or Columbus, Ohio, for military police duty. So I picked Cleveland, Ohio. So they sent me there.
Any particular reason Cleveland over Columbus?
I thought it was closer to home. I have no other reason, because I didn't know one town from another. You know. I got to Cleveland, Ohio, and we checked in with the military police there. And after we got there right away, we stayed right in their headquarters, just in the office, There was no camps or anything. We just had bunks and stuff. So I asked them if I could bring my wife down. He said, yeah, but you can't stay here. Well, I said, can I go and rent an apartment someplace? Yeah, you can do that.
Great.
So I did. So I went out and I found an apartment for $12 a week.
Wow.
That was the rent. I called her and she worked for the Selective Services. She's a... She's a government worker, so she came and she got a job the next day at the she got a job at the car or the bus terminal in the ordnance department, Army Ordnance Department. And she and Dell arrived this morning at the Greyhound bus depot while I was on duty when she came. Mm-hmm. She stayed around bus depot most of the time until I went off duty at 4 p.m. then went to my headquarters where I notified them that we were moving out to our apartment. We liked this little place, and it's fun to live in a civilian home instead of those army bunks. Mm-hmm. And that's when she started Martin I. Norton in the department. And the rest of this is just a military police duty.
So you finished out your military career as a military policeman?
As a military policeman in Cleveland, Ohio.
What was that like?
It was kind of interesting. It's kind of out of my line of work, but it was interesting. We had to have a government driver's license for one thing, and then we worked together with the detective bureau and the police department, so that any soldier that was AWOL from his camp, the camp would send a notice to the police department in town, say that such and such a guy from that town is AWOL. And to pick him up, so if the police would turn it over to the military police, that was us, then we'd go out to them, try to find them, and send them back.
Did you have a lot of good luck finding them?
We found them in all kinds of places.
Really? Where was the most unusual place?
Well, I see again. We went out to a soldier's home this morning and asked his wife where her husband was. He said he was not at home and didn't know where he was. We went through the rooms and finally found him hiding in a closet behind a bunch of dresses. He had been AWOL for 4 months. This afternoon we were out near my place on 58th Street and dropped in. We had the offer in his lunch.
When you found that soldier that was AWOL hiding behind his wife's dresses in the closet and you took him into custody, what happened to him after that?
They were glad we caught him.
Really?
Yeah, they were glad we caught him because most of the time it's the family that keeps them going back. The soldier wants to go back, but they're afraid for him, you know, especially in Cleveland, there's a many colored people there, and their mama's boys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the ones. So they're glad when they're caught. They come willingly. There's no problem.
They go right back to duty then?
They go right back to camp.
Oh.
Then they'll get punished for being AWOL.
Okay. I mean, what punishment?
Well, I don't know. They put them in the guardhouse, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. How bad it is, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they do. So we went on a lot of these calls here.
Albert, can you tell us about some of the people you met during your time in the service? Any special buddies?
Right from Pelicanville, by the name of Warner Mueller.
Mm-hmm.
He's in the same outfit. He was in A Company, I was in B Company. And then there was another guy, his name of Larson. He was from Erhard, east of Erhard.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were two guys named Uselman from Wadena.
Do you still keep in contact with them?
We did, but most of them have passed away now.
Unfortunately.
And there's one in South Dakota, a fellow named Tony Cutter. Now he's still living, but we used to have Army reunions.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to all of them?
I went to just about every one of them, and now they discontinued that about 3 years ago because there wasn't enough people left. Dying out.
Very sad. How did you feel about leaving the military after 4 years?
Well, I think I've done my duties.
Definitely.
As a veteran.
Mm-hmm. Are you excited to get on with the rest of your life?
Yeah, and I'm still involved. I've been an active member in the VFW Color Guard in Moorhead for many, many years. Also a member of the American Legion.
What did you do after you left the military?
I started working at Horvick Electric in Moorhead.
And how long did you work there?
I was there for 34 years.
Terrific. Albert, do you have any final thoughts about what you went through while serving your country?
Well, I don't regret what I did. I think that was very educational.
Mm-hmm.
I came out of it without any handicap. I never had too much schooling, but I think that was equivalent to 4 years of high school plus, mm-hmm. you know, that
real
training.
Education.
Yeah, because it helped me in my job, because I started out as a flunky in cleaning motors where I was working, and in a few years I was made shop foreman. I was shop foreman for 14 years, and I bought into the business, and when I was 48 years old, I was appointed president and manager of the company.
Terrific.
Plus, I was one-third owner.
Terrific.
And I retired in 1979.
Have you been enjoying retirement?
I have, yeah. We had a lake home, and I done a lot of work down there. I had a big garden down there, and we done a lot of touring around. We've been to Europe a couple times, been to Australia, Mexico.
What was it like going back to Australia as a civilian?
I wish I could. No, I said Mexico.
Oh, okay.
No, I never went back to Australia.
You didn't.
It would have been nice. One time I almost did, but the fare was $5,000, and mm-hmm. I just couldn't afford it.
It's expensive.
But we went on a lot of bus tours, the wife and I. We've been all over the United States.
That's great.
Yeah.
Albert, how would you like to be remembered?
As a good soldier.
Mm-hmm. Anything else above that?
Well, can't think of anything right now, but I think I've done my duty to the country.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Albert.
You're welcome.